Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty. And a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Danielle Paradis. Contributing editor at, what's that website? Canada Land, based out of Edmonton. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Jesse.
Today on the show, Premier Jason Kenney makes a poo in his hat, puts the hat on, does a little dance, makes sure that everybody's seen the hat. These are just the facts, people. I'm just reporting the news here. We're going to talk about the Alberta government's absurd report against journalists. And CBC management does not go looking through people's personal accounts to see what they are up to. They just don't. However, more fallout from the shitstorm. Welcome to Scatological Shortcuts, Danny.
Is that what we're going with, Jesse?
That's what it is this week. This episode is brought to everybody by Paul Collins, Jennifer Zetto, Kendra Perrin, Chloe Wiles Speakman, Spencer Campbell, Keegan McAvoy, Jackie Harkins, and Daniel Polotsky.
Hi, I'm Daniel and I'm a student in Montreal. I listen to Canada Land because Jesse manages to keep me both informed and entertained week after week. I think the whole Canada Land team is doing necessary and excellent work with shows like Commons and Return to Thunder Bay. While I was sad to see Oppo go this year, I am very excited about Jesse's promise to introduce a full-time French language beat. And not to toot my own horn, but I had called that Émilie Nicolas would be somehow part of that. Émilie, super content pour toi, tu joins à une merveilleuse équipe. J'ai hâte de t'entendre. Keep up the great work, guys.
Danny, I've known for some time that Jason Kenney has this like Trumpian, the press is the enemy, with a little bit of like a prairie twist, like the press is out to get the oil sands. I think he ran on that. I know about this war room he set up, like a government-funded combat PR thing to fight journalists. Anyhow, this has taken a new turn this week, and I'm wondering if you can just take us through it.
This week, Vice News actually came out with an article where they had acquired one of the reports that's commissioned by what is called the Allen Inquiry. Stephen Allen, he is a forensic accountant, and he's the person who's been tasked with what is called the Anti-Albertan Inquiry. It's a $3.5 million investment by the province. This is the result of a promise that Jason Kenney made on the campaign trail. Vivian Krause has been talking about this for some time. She's reviewed some documentation and she really believes that there is a U.S. and environmental joint conspiracy to prevent Alberta from being able to get their product to Tidewater. This was an important message to Albertans because we are in the middle of an economic depression. we're not seeing $100 barrels for oil and gas, and it's very challenging to balance our budget because we are a resource economy. And there are entire communities that are supported by oil and gas here. That said, the inquiry has sort of been talking both sides out of its mouth, and I think the report that was released from the inquiry, which was commissioned by them but isn't their final report, hints at that, because on one hand, they say the inquiry and the website that explains it is saying we're not trying to prove or disprove climate change. It's not what we're looking at. On the other hand, this report is just pages and pages where any environmental activity or any mention of climate change seems to be really suspicious.
That was a very fair and reasonable explanation for something that I think is just wild. First of all, the anti-Alberta inquiry, it's not the inquiry that's anti-Alberta. It's an inquiry into anti-Albertan practices. And sure, they're not taking a side. They're just inquiring. Vice had the story. It was Jeff Dembicki for Vice reporting. Alberta inquiry paid $28,000 for a report smearing hundreds of climate journalists. You know, whenever you read something like the government paid this much money for this report that's doing something bad, it's usually like they paid $1 million for this report that's audacious, or they spent way too much money for this report that's audacious. In this instance, they paid $28,000. I think they got what they paid for.
I think they overpaid.
That's true. It's both very little for a report with the ambitions that this report had and way too much for what was actually written. Who wrote this report?
This report was written by a Dr. Nemeth.
Who I is not affiliated with any research organization or university. This document, it's called A New Global Paradigm: Understanding the Transnational Progressive Movement, the Energy Transition, and the Great Transformation Strangling Alberta's Petroleum Industry. This is a report, people, it's got to be true, that billionaires George Soros, Michael Bloomberg, the World Economic Forum, the Rockefellers, they're leading an international movement to catalyze massive economic and social changes under the pretext of limiting limiting global carbon dioxide emissions. The report, Danny, it contemplates a certain future, if we keep going down the path we're on, in Canada, in which life, quote, will be constantly monitored, short, cold and miserable, just like pre-industrial times. Terrifying stuff. And who's to blame? The media. Can you tell us a bit about what role the media plays in this great conspiracy against Albertans and freedom?
Yes. So the media is covering this information. I suppose the crux of the matter is whether or not climate change is true. And most of us do believe that it is. This report obviously doesn't believe that. So if you have to come at it from that perspective.
Wait a second. Who are you working for? Who paid you to say that?
I guess you, technically, Jesse. The report goes into the Society for Environmental Journalists, who are describing their mission statement as assisting journalists with responsibly covering complex environmental issues. And then it really goes on to take issue with progressive organizations such as the Hewlett Foundation, Powered Foundation, Wilderness Society. And it sort of insinuates that the only reason a journalist would cover anything about climate change is because they're a part of a transnational progressive movement with the intention to, although it doesn't say bring Alberta down, that's kind of the implication here.
Here's from the report. But what if the revolution could take place without violence because people were convinced to voluntarily overthrow the system in order to save the world? This is what the transnational progressive movement is working towards in 2020. It goes on to say that essentially the entire media in Canada is captured by this great transformation movement. And like the connection they draw is the fact that there is this Society of Environmental Journalists. I guess that's the connection. Though not everybody is guilty here. The report says there are exceptions, like the National Post and Sun News Network. Sun News Network has been off the air for years. This report is written by a British woman. I am angry, I feel like it's important to be angry about this more than I feel angry about it, because it's so silly. And I think that if the idea for years, Danny, has been that And this is like, you know, what Ezra Levant wrote about in Ethical Oil, his book. And this is like, we've been hearing this for years, that the media is in the tank and funded by tides and funded by these foreign interests. And the oil sands are, you know, are the most ethical oil in the world, but they're being targeted under the guise of environmentalism. Now you've got a government legitimizing that conspiracy theory and saying, we're going to prove it. We're going to pay people to do research and they're going to show this. So it's hard for me to be angry when the result of that is this like sad trombone. There's nothing tangible in this, even in a conspiratorial way. Like, I don't think there's one article mentioned or a factual error mentioned. There's just the same kind of like, this is connected to that, and therefore they're all in it against us. So it's hard to get angry against something that's so sad and pathetic.
Well, we haven't seen the final report from the commission either. And there is good reason to be angry. There's good reason to be really concerned. Going after journalists for covering the truth is very McCarthy era, the anti-L. Burton inquiry as well. There's just a lot of messaging in here that's extremely troubling. And there's been some trouble reported with the inquiry itself, in that environmental groups haven't been engaged. So Greenpeace Canada, for example, is an organization that will undoubtedly be maligned. If you think about, if you were to ask an Albertan or maybe even across Canada, who's against the oil sands, Greenpeace is, of course, an organization that comes up. And yet they haven't been contacted by the inquiry to make any kind of comment. And what is the point? That's what I find myself asking about this entire situation. So, okay, Vivian Krause produced a movie. She's worried that there's a global conspiracy. Keystone XL was just canceled. That may not be a global conspiracy. That may just be that the industry, oil and gas industry, is in decline, and people who are looking beyond 5 to 10 years, where we're certainly going to keep using oil in the short term, where they are looking further than most politicians do and deciding, okay, we have to make adjustments to how we fund these things and how we can shift to funding for a more renewable resource.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Vivian Krause is somebody who has been, in my opinion, kind of a low-rent bagman for this this theory, where she gets various research contracts and speaking gigs to kind of like prove that this is so. The problem, you know, with distinguishing this conspiracy theory from reality is that many of the things we're talking about are true. It's true that some billionaires are funneling huge amounts of money into various types of ways to fight climate change, to educate about climate change and to stop climate change, which is consistent with some very wealthy people saying, wow, I accept science. The world is in serious trouble and I have the ability and the resources to do something about it. And it's consistent that like you'll find some of the same messaging in journalists' work, which is explainable either by a massive conspiracy or the fact that climate change is real. So it's a bias that will keep confirming itself down the road. And there is a day when the truth catches up with you. And I just see this as that. Kenny ran a campaign that was not just counterfactual, but kind of counter reality, like telling Albertans things they wanted to hear, that it was possible to reclaim the glory days by fighting these anti-Albertan influences. It was possible that Keystone would go through. It was possible to beat the environmentalists. But the biggest threat to Alberta isn't the environmentalists. It's that the, you know, massive investment funds, trillion-dollar investment funds, are divesting completely from fossil fuels. And so he was able to grab power with that messaging, but now he's kind of got to follow through on those promises. And this is just sort of the inevitable sad result. And I guess you're right. The thing they get angry about is like it's never cool or okay for the government to be targeting journalists for simply reporting what we know from science to be true. Like, that's scary. Like, here's our multi-million dollar campaign, our war room, our inquiry into the anti-Albertans. It's scarier more by the technical facts of it than the impact, because I don't know, from my remove, he just looks ludicrous.
The Canadian Association of Journalists, I just wanted to point that out, have come out condemning Alberta's efforts to discredit climate journalists. It's certainly an embarrassing discussion. We do have people who do cover oil and gas and climate change locally. We have Emma Graney as well as Max Fawcett, who used to be the editor for Alberta Oil and used to work for the Notley government in the climate office. So there are very intelligent journalists, very fair-minded people. I've been out for drinks with them, and they don't appear to be paying for drinks with, like, the Tide Foundation.
Yeah, but you would say that.
Well, I mean, they haven't bought my drinks, and I just feel like if they are, then they should be paying for everybody, right? Like, what good is that activist money?
We've already established your agenda.
That's right.
The full results from the Allen inquiry are expected on January 31st. And that's where I do expect some more detail about exactly which journalists are part of this conspiracy. Danielle Paradis, we have so much to duly note today. I want to duly note a brand new Canadian media org that has popped up called Buzz. And it is co-founded by somebody who's been on this show before, Jaskaran Singh Sandhu. This is like a micro news org. They're starting out Twitter account, Substack. It features opinions, ideas, and original reporting for the Sikh and Punjabi diaspora. The reason I'm duly noting them is that like right out the gate, they scored like a pretty solid scoop. This is an interesting dynamic of Canadian media. We often have politicians giving interviews to French language media or Mandarin language media or Punjabi language media. And when they do that, they will sometimes say things in these other languages that they wouldn't say in English. And I've thought before, you know, if you just translated every time they did that, I bet you just like always be getting scoops. Well, Buzz actually did that. And right away, they saw Liberal MP Ramesh Sangha on Y Media in a Punjabi interview parroting these totally debunked Indian state media accusations about former Minister Navdeep Bains. There's all these conspiracy theories going around about why Navdeep Bains departed from politics. And here he was saying things he would not say in English. And Buzz just said, okay, well, here's what he said. And the impact was swift. Sangha has been booted out of the Liberal caucus. The story got picked up by major media outlets, who I think, as far as I can tell, are behaving decently and crediting Buzz. More importantly, Danny, Instagram poet Rupi Kaur retweeted Buzz News to her 250,000 followers. And so I guess what I want to do is welcome to the world, Buzz News.
Duly noted. I wanted to just highlight this story out of Quebec. 19 media outlets in Quebec have signed an open letter calling on the Quebec government and public health authorities to give journalists access to the province's health institutions. What they're talking about in this letter is a concern that they're not able to accurately capture the pandemic and the effects of the pandemic because they're not being allowed into these rooms to take pictures. And that's something that it's important because it's important to bear witness to what's happening in our healthcare system. You think about the people who have become COVID truthers, and if they're not seeing these photos, then doesn't it just continue to reinforce that this is some sort of Chinese conspiracy or government conspiracy? Pick your favorite conspiracy and who you want to blame.
Duly noted. Okay, next one for me. At an anti-mask rally at Yonge Dundas Square, a City TV camera operator was kicked out by the cops. And it was just a dumb cop who didn't know that media are essential services. And when City complained about this afterwards and said, no, he is essential, we are essential, the police confirmed, yeah, yeah, we've made sure the cops now know and your cameraman can come back. But it is something that I took note of because when lockdown happened and this category of essential worker was necessary to go out and work, first of all, who knew if lockdown was going to be more than a week or whatever? And we were just like relieved that media was even considered essential at all. So the way that they defined media was under telecommunications. Here in Ontario, it's under telecommunications, radio or TV are essential workers. I was not really satisfied with that as a definition of who's allowed to go out and do journalism. But okay, I was in a permissive mood because I know government was doing the best they can. Now we're living in lockdown in some kind of ongoing way. And if that camera person had been for a digital news outlet holding up their phone to report the news as opposed to a TV news camera, I guess it would have been okay for the cops to throw him out of there. I mean, I support this guy's right to report the news entirely. I'm glad that he was able to return. But it just occurred to me like, wow, we are living in a situation where it is against the law to go and report the news unless you are in a tightly defined definition of journalist as set by the provincial government. And that's the society that I live in now. Canada Land squeezes in because we're syndicated on radio, so we can still do our jobs. But why limit to radio and TV that those who are allowed to go out and do journalism? It feels like that's at least deserving of some notation.
Duly noted.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Danielle, I want to return to a story that I guess originated with the Canada Land story, but and we've heard about it last week. Ryan and Karen were talking about it, and other people were first to break the most recent developments of it. What am I talking about? People will know the bones of this. Amr Khan was at the bottom of a hierarchical organization. Amr Khan was, I think, a 24-year-old young temp journalist at the CBC, an organization where at the top, it's a technicality that Don Cherry is broadcast by the CBC but employed by somebody else. You've got somebody at the bottom, and then at the top, they're broadcasting, glorifying this old bigot, and he's saying atrocious things. And that's the company that Amr Khan works for. They're putting Don Cherry on the air, and he's saying that these immigrants come over here, and they're ungrateful, and they don't wear their poppies. And Amr Khan said something about it, as we are supposed to say. He said that this is racist, and that this has something to do with why brown kids don't like playing hockey. And Canada Land found out, and I can say now we found out from him, he was an anonymous source at the time, that the CBC asked him to take down his tweets. And I'm getting into this now because there's been some development on this story. I'm going to say a couple things about it, though, that just my own reflection to add to a lot of voices. When racialized journalists and women and people in the field talk about, and they often talk about it on Canada Land, things like microaggressions or lateral violence in the workplace, I know that there are people out there, I know because I read my email, who roll their eyes and think that this is some millennial whining and like, oh, microaggressions, you've got some micro problems. And they fail to see the hellish reality of how things actually play out. And I think that this case, because there was an arbitration over this and the arbitrator's ruling went public and we got to read step by step what happened to Amr Khan after the CBC asked him to pull his tweet, why they asked him to pull his tweet and what happened to him afterwards. This was a rare chance, Danielle, I think, where people got to see documented in plain words exactly what microaggressions look like and how this very vulnerable worker came in to be a target where his colleague and boss were conspiring against him, going into his personal messages, taking out of context material that would make him look like a homophobe or a sexist, completely inappropriate shit. I don't even want to engage with this. Well, is he a homophobe or a sexist? Because we shouldn't even know about what he was talking about with his friends. Everyone was right to be disgusted by what his colleague and his boss did. But the part of it that I felt was undealt with until this week, and Manisha Krishnan Advice broke this aspect of it. The part that I think somebody was getting off easy was At an early stage, his boss went to her boss, one of her bosses, Paul Hambleton, who basically is an executive at the CBC who runs their standards and practices. He's the grand poobah if you've got a question about whether the rules have been broken. It was Hambleton who said, if Amr Khan wants to be an activist, he should step down. Everyone hears what they want to hear from Don Cherry. And there it is right there. If you want to say that racism is racism, get the fuck out of here. You're no journalist. That's activism, says the guy who runs the CBC standards and practices. There were no repercussions for Paul Hambleton until just recently. And what Manisha Krishnan reported was that a letter from over 100 CBC workers called for, not for Paul Hambleton's resignation, but what they said was, it shouldn't be this guy and it shouldn't be any guy or anybody. It should be a panel of people who are making decisions about whether the rules have been broken. We should share that power. That's the news from Manisha, who's been doing a great job of covering developments on this. And I was just glad to see the story move there because it's the systemic structural stuff from on high where I think the problem really rests.
Oh, absolutely. Like if you think, I don't know if you're familiar with Nextdoor or if you're on it, but even they do better than this when it comes to looking at standards. Even they have team leads, people weigh in on whether or not something is appropriate. So the idea that one person should be the arbiter of what is journalistic integrity or whether or not somebody's following standards, that seems like a very outdated concept. At the very least, there should be a panel. And there needs to be some recognition that for people of color, journalists who are people of color, it is impossible to separate your lived experience from the way you react to comments that are racist. I'm thinking of this story I just read in APTN about an Indigenous woman who died in a hospital, and it seems that there wasn't a lot of care given to her. Like, how can I take that as an Indigenous person with a sort of impartiality when you can see that can be you, this has directly affected you, and to pretend that everybody should aspire to this sort of like middle-aged white man notion of, I don't have any biases, I don't like anything, I don't dislike anything. I just thought we were done with this, and I think in 2021, we should finally leave it all behind.
Well, the Empire Strikes Back, you know, like it's interesting to see how when there was a big noise made over the summer, everybody was kind of with power was on their back heel saying we're going to change, change is coming. But then the way things were tend to reassert themselves. And, you know, CBC's mumbling some letter to everybody saying, everybody, we know that you're really upset about this, you know, but please, please trust us. We are not in the business of reading your personal messages. However, and they actually said, however, in this instance, we kind of had to do it. They assured us that they were going to have internal processes to deal with everybody's concerns over the summer. But I think it's just going to continue to take these things going public and other outside sources humiliating them until these changes happen. Like that, like that's what actually makes institutions change a lot quicker than these internal processes. And, you know, this might not be unrelated to this front page of the National Post. I do see this trend of a pushback against whatever progress was made over the summer. So the National Post had a front page that I think went largely ignored online. And it's interesting also, kind of as a side note, the National Post is packaging stories for print very differently than for social media. And it's almost like they're kind of segmenting their audience. They know their print audience will be okay with certain things that their online audience, it's going to cause trouble. So it was a lot more buried online than it was in print, where it was on a big front page where Barbara Kay has announced Jessica Mulrooney not guilty. Wow. Didn't see that one coming. Jessica Mulrooney, it turns out, writes Barbara Kay in a 17-minute read, this long read from Barbara Kay, she's got the receipts. It turns out Jessica Mulrooney, writes Barbara Kay, was stitched up. She was not a racist all along, and these text messages prove it, but the rest of the media won't publish them. And this whole thing, first, I'm like, didn't Jessica Mulrooney, like, acknowledge that she had done something wrong? Didn't Ben Mulrooney, like, step down from one of his jobs as acknowledgement that they had done something wrong? Like, I was unaware that there was this voice in the wilderness crying out for innocence. To remind people as quickly as I can, at the essence of this story, Jessica Mulrooney apologized because when she felt like she was being unfairly publicly dragged by a black woman named Sasha Exeter, who's an Instagram influencer type person. Jessica Mulrooney basically said, stop doing that to me or I will call your sponsors and I will like cut you off from your livelihood. That was the thing that she was exposed for having done. And that's the thing that she apologized for. Barbara Kay says, no, I've got the truth. Danny, I actually read this article.
Me too, and I'm kind of mad about it.
Wasn't it like torture? Like, it was so painful to read this thing.
It was really bad. I feel like I need to bill you extra.
I mean, basically, it does give you more information about what happened, and it's like Jessica basically is just going back and forth in these text messages to Sasha Exeter, profusely groveling, apologizing. I'm so sorry if I offended you. Please don't humiliate me further. Please don't humiliate me further. I'm so sorry. And I'll concede that Sasha Exeter doesn't look great in this exchange because as Jessica, I think, begs, Sasha does not relent and says, you know, just so you know, heads up, I got three inquiries from various news organizations about this, basically saying, I will be talking about this publicly. And Jessica Mulrooney is saying, no, no, please don't. And it is then that she does what she's accused of having done, which is says, if you do this, I will call up your sponsors. So it's like a more fulsome account of this triviality, but it doesn't change the actual thing that happened. And I guess I bring it up mostly because, like, Denny, I can understand, I don't agree, but I understand with journalists who felt like Wendy Mesley got a raw deal. Like, that Wendy Mesley served as a journalist for decades and cared about her work, and they had personal relationships with her and collegiate relationships with her, and that this one incident cost her everything, and they went to battle for Wendy Mesley. And they weren't willing to let Wendy Mesley's reputation go without standing up for her. But Jessica Mulrooney? Like, the establishment can't spare Jessica Mulrooney. It's like, if they can get Jessica Mulrooney, none of us are safe. I watched this whole thing play out over the summer where it was like, Jessica apologized, Ben kind of apologized, and then the Mulrooney name is tarnished. So what do I read in the Globe and Mail? Like, shortly thereafter, out of the blue, it's an op-ed by Brian Mulrooney on, like, you know, Canada's international affairs or something. Just like, reminder, everybody, we're not just a tabloid family. I'm a serious statesman with opinions. And it was not enough to save Jessica's reputation. So months later, it's the front page of the National Post that we don't have the full story. It's a bit tutu.
Culturally, there's this trope of the angry black woman. I think Barbara Kay is really leaning on this trope. In this article, she really, you know, Jessica Mulrooney is the victim here from this perspective. And yet, Sasha Exeter, who, you know, experiences life as a woman of color, and she talks about that frequently in the communication back and forth with Jessica. It just seems like Barbara Kay ignores that entire perspective, because of course she would, because that's all just woke culture nonsense. The first line really just tells you what the story is about, right? Cancel culture is pandemic today, but the virus was already in patchy play 30 years ago. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, it's a callback to, like, you know, the first victim, the canary in the coal mine, was June Callwood, is Barbara Kay's argument there. Listen, Barbara Kay has to even, like, kind of footnote and annotate in order to kind of accept this new revisionist narrative of this thing that I think we've given far too much attention to. You have to accept that when Jessica Mulrooney was apologizing to Sasha, like, Barbara Kay has in parentheses, there's like a transcript and Jessica's like, I'm so sorry. And then Barbara Kay interjects, Jessica doesn't even know what she's apologizing for here. Mm-hmm. She's just so terrorized by this angry black person. So you have to accept as part of this new narrative that Jessica is just falsely apologizing and falsely contrite.
And that she's broken. There's a line there too, one of Barbara's editorial lines about, finally Jessica breaks before she makes that threat about going to the brands.
That's it. She wasn't really threatening to cut off, to go and complain about Sasha. It was all she could take. I don't know what to tell you. That's your Canada Land Shortcuts. Danny, thank you.
Thanks, Jesse.
Listen, you can email me at my brand new email address, jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Danny, where is your Twitter account to be found?
At Danny Parody.
Our website, which you are helping us edit now, is canadaland.com. This episode, produced by Tiffany Lamb, with additional production by Kevin Sexton. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt, and our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do, we could use your support, and we'd like to give you some ad-free podcasts and some other stuff. So go to canadaland.com/join, or just click the link in your show notes. It takes like a minute to support the production of this and everything else that we do.